is a good software developer? What do excellent developers do? There are probably as many answers to these questions as developers in the world. So let's ask veterans and newcomers what their story looks like. Let's learn directly from them. Welcome to Developer's Journey. Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining light on developers' life from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Mario Rodrik. Mario is a technology aficionado with a particular love for the web. You will see why very soon. He believes technology should make life simple and joyful, and he enjoys being able to prove so. He currently lives in London and works as head of technology for Locomote.com, but is about to start on a new project, and maybe we'll hear what today. Well, we'll see. Mario finally organizes and runs the Elm London meetups and frequently teach and speak about Elm to diverse audiences. Mario, thank you very much for joining.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. About those diverse audiences, this is exactly the point we last discussed with each other. I was in London a few months ago, I think, and you were about to go to Paris to give a talk about Elm at Elm Europe, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So of course I want to know how that went, but I would also love to know how you ended up in a position, being able to give international talks at such a conference. Can you give us an idea of how the journey looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's, I suppose it could be a very, very long story, a very, very short story. but maybe to start, Elm Europe was really, really fantastic. Personally for me, it's super energizing. I kind of have a feeling with Elm, given that it's a young new language, it's kind of similar to when I originally got into Ruby. I don't know, maybe that was 07 or 08 or so. And it's kind of just like there's just a huge amount of excitement in a community. I think that's kind of starting from scratch and, you know, doesn't have a lot of baggage yet and is kind of like pushing new boundaries. So absolutely. If folks listening are interested in functional programming and pike their interest in Elm, I can definitely recommend Elm Europe as a really amazing conference. But to answer the more windy and turny question of how one ends up speaking at international conferences. I mean, the simple answer is you go online, you find a CFP, you apply, you get selected, and you speak. Practically, there's not much more to it. But I suppose there is at least maybe from a self-identity or a personal confidence or a skill set point of view, there's probably some more hoops that folks probably need to jump to. At least I can say for myself personally, it wasn't, you know, my first speaking experience definitely wasn't an international conference. I think for me, it was kind of something that I was very lucky to be exposed to when I was younger through our church and our youth group. We had a ton of various activities, and in kind of one way or another, by being involved with that, I found myself either needing to speak, not to huge audiences, but, you know, to slightly bigger audiences, or to kind of organize groups and do various things. And I don't know, I kind of felt that through that, you know, maybe I just got exposure and had a little bit better of a baseline comfort maybe than some of my peers. I remember not being as, of course, nervous having to, you know, do kind of oral speeches at high school on some topics, or you know, maybe having to present something to the teacher or whatever else it might be at those kind of younger ages was still quite nerve-wracking. But I don't know, kind of little by little you realize, like, oh, okay, you know, speaking to 10 people is not that different to speaking to 5, and then speaking to 20 is not that different to 10. And I think sometimes there's a tipping point where I think maybe for like a school assembly or something, maybe later on in like year 12, I had to do a speech. And then you suddenly realize, you know, there's way, way, way more people in the room than you can maintain eye contact with. Mm. I think that's definitely a transitional boundary between, you know, I'm speaking to these 10 people and I can cycle through and see how they're all feeding back to me. But when you have such an overwhelming audience, maybe it's quite different. But yeah, I mean, the cliche, the kind of cliche thing of just putting yourself out there and giving it a go and then subsequently finding that it gets easier is definitely, I think definitely has some truth to it. And I'd probably also encourage people that that maybe haven't tried doing that. There's, well, you can probably find on YouTube that there's quite a few talks from prominent speakers speaking about how nervous they still are speaking, which I find that meta kind of like you're talking about the thing you're nervous about by doing the thing you're nervous about on stage. You know, it's a crazy, crazy utility to be able to express those ideas. But yeah, even people that have been doing it for a very, very long time are not necessarily comfortable with it. And then some people are just absolutely natural, right? Like they very, you know, very kind of naturally gifted speakers. But yeah, I think like all things in life, it kind of comes down to practice. So, you know, when I was a little bit older, speaking, you know, in university for assignments or presentations, I started going to programming meetups while I was living in Sydney. And, you know, you see two people speaking and then maybe you get excited about something. And I think I'm, if I remember correctly, one of the meetups that I went to, there was somebody that kind of encouraged lots of people and, He was actually quite sly about it because after the meetup, he would go around and talk to everybody. And, you know, if you were excitedly talking about something, he would engage with you more and more and more and drag it out of you. And then he would turn around later and go, oh, nice one. You're going to talk about that next meetup. And you kind of be like, what? No. Like, he's like, yeah. Like, you're clearly passionate about it. You know a lot about it. And like, done. Like, you should tell other people it's going to be really, really cool. And you're just casually just kind of affirming people and maybe kind of supporting the idea that what they have to say and what they think actually has value, even if they might not think it does. You know, definitely even still, like I can say for this this conference talk that I did just now at the Pastel meetup, you know, there's that little niggly monkey on your shoulder saying, oh, you know, most of these people probably already know what you're talking about. You know, most of them probably going to be bored. You know, most of them, you know, that kind of imposter syndrome, I think nobody is really immune to. So, yeah, that's a bash at the windy, the windy explanation.
But of course, why would you want to speak at such conferences? What's the rationale behind it? Is there a need behind it? Really an idea that you want to convey and why in a spoken form and not in an article or writing a book or something?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. I think something maybe that I've realized a lot more deeply in the more recent part of my career is that, you know, despite all of our technological advancements, there's something really fundamental about people communicating together in person. So even though that I think there is definitely a time and place for blog posts or articles or, you know, other kinds of medium, podcasts like this one, of course, yeah, I think that there's a set of skills that you can gain from doing a conference talk or from doing a meetup talk or just presenting something in general that I think are really quite valuable and don't really come into need in other forums. So, you know, you might say, yes, definitely if you're writing an article, you need to quite be to the point. But there's a little bit less of a prerogative because everybody gets to pace through the article at their own speed, right? So, you know, one person might read it slowly, another person might read it quite quickly and skim through it. another person might get bored two sentences in and leave. Like the cost to the reader isn't that high. However, when you're in a conference setting or in a meetup setting, at least perceptionally, I mean, in reality, it's still the same. It doesn't matter. Like if someone doesn't want to listen, that's their problem, not yours. From a kind of personal value point of view, it's not your fault if they don't want to listen, right? But from a psychological point of view, there's a little bit more of an imperative to be like, okay, well, I have the, I actually spoke about this at the beginning of last year's talk at Elm Europe. It was like, I have the privilege as a speaker of having your undivided attention, which kind of in today's day and age, I mean, I don't know, if you consider what advertisers pay for to get, you know, half a second of you scrolling past their advertisement on a Twitter feed, and then you compare that to, you know, a full audience with 100% undivided attention to one single individual speaking about something, there's a, you know, there's kind of like a compelling sense of value there, right? Like you're taking all these people's time. You've got their a clear attention and a little bit more of an imperative to make the most of that, right? So I think it forces you to learn things like, what is it, you know, what is it exactly that you want to say? What do you want to convey to these people? How can you most effectively articulate that idea? How can you read your audience to understand, are they, you know, are they grasping what you're saying? Are you giving enough detail or too much detail? Are you going too fast? Are you going too slow? Yeah, there's I feel that those kind of human elements are really, really interesting skills, and I guess throughout my career, in my role in particular, I kind of gravitated towards leadership roles. There come a lot of times where I've done things in the past, like say like a town hall or, you know, a team meeting or something like that. And I've gone to give a particular message. And then having done more and more conference talks, or meetup talks or whatever it might be, kind of gone back and rethought some of those other interactions I've had and gone, oh man, like I really didn't respect those people's times. I wasn't prepared. I rambled. I wasn't sure what point I wanted to make. And yeah, I guess for me, in some ways, I found that, you know, benefits go both ways in better being able to learn the skill sets that at least in my perception make for good presentations and good conference or meetup talks. I found that some of my other interactions with teams and how I communicate improved, and then, you know, learning the things from that relatively much more frequent practicing kind of platform within your day job also kind of feeds back in to how you present at conferences and stuff. So mm-hmm. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. This is why I'm pushing so many of my colleagues to do this. Is even if you're not interested in giving talks for the talks themselves, it's such a great exercise and platform for your day-to-day life. You will have to present at some point. You will have to talk to your peers. Even if that's just one person sitting beside you, and we call that pair programming, but you will have to do some presentation of ideas and structured, complex ideas at some point. And so you have to try at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting point you make. I just realized something I was thinking about recently is when you're doing a conference talk, because the stakes are higher, I think you're a little bit more aware of certain things. And then it's really interesting how when those stakes aren't there, we kind of creep out and abuse things. So for example, something that I see a lot, or that I have seen a lot in my current job is, you know, we're quite a large corporate. So communication of information is a pretty big deal, right? Like it's something that, that a lot of people kind of do on a daily basis. And for that, we, you know, we use PowerPoints, we make presentations. But it's really, really interesting how many people you have, that maybe have never done like a public speaking talk and have never, kind of tried those skills or learned anything about that realm, but do, and, you know, wouldn't be comfortable doing that either. They would be very, very nervous. However, kind of day to day, they're very, very, very comfortable doing that within the workplace. And I think part of that, causes certain problems. So for example, one of the things that I learned, kind of by trial and error is that you can't have too many messages in a presentation because you'll lose people, right? Like if you're trying to convey 17 different things, people are going to start losing track of what the point is. Now, I mean, you can have 17 detailed items, but if they're grouped up into, you know, two or three higher key points, that's okay that you're using them to reinforce those key points. But I kind of always, at least what I say to myself is, you know, what two or three things do I want people to walk away from this talk? If they remember nothing else that I've said, what do I want them to remember? And then trying to take that and apply it to like a corporate deck, you know, and especially when, you know, we sit down with a team to review a deck and it's already at like 73 slides, you know, and every slide is just completely crammed with information. And then trying to articulate to a group of people like, hey guys, like maybe no one's going to get any, you know, like, so it's interesting. On the one hand, it's like, oh, we have to have all the information because, you know, we have to be ready for anything. But then on the other hand, it's like, yes, but if you're ready for anything, you'd be ready for nothing. Like you won't have a message, right? Like, so anyway, as an aside, I find that quite hilarious.
Yeah, it is. It is. In my current project, we made some kind of joke and it became really serious, sending an email and saying, well, you know, next week on Tuesday, the Beamer is not going to work. The people, what? what do you mean it's not going to work? Well, we kind of know already the Beamer is not going to work. So you will have to do without the presentation. You will have to find another way to present. And people were freaking out. But the presentation was gorgeous. It was really fun. People came up with really creative ideas how to convey the message anyway. And it was really fun. So
yeah. Absolutely. I love this thing. I guess that temptation of that tooling is too large, right? Like it's just the easy thing to do is dump information on slides. If you take that away, then you're forced to. That's a great idea. I think I'm going to go around unplugging projectors and pretending that they all suddenly don't work and see what happens.
Well,
and suddenly have a huge spike in communication efficiency in the business.
We were not so nasty. We told people beforehand we wanted to still have a nice meeting, and still should be okay. But that's also an idea. Could do that.
Yeah.
So chaos monkey style.
yeah, absolutely.
Let's roll back a second as well. So we talked about why speaking, but you mentioned the word imposter syndrome. You have to find something you could be talking about. How did you come up with topics or with ideas on what to talk about on stage?
So suppose there's a part of my personality from when I was very, very young was kind of tearing things apart and putting them back together. So my dad's work kind of gave me the opportunity during summer breaks and stuff to kind of tag along with him. And there was always something to, you know, like an old computer or an old printer or lots of kind of office supply stuff, old kind of phones, like the big phones that used to come in two parts with like the call bit, like a mobile phone, right? But it was like a home phone with this giant battery pack and all linked together, right? And these are all things that have been chucked in the trash. So there was, you know, there was no way for me to break it any more than it had been broken, and ripping stuff apart and seeing how it worked, I suppose was I guess kind of like an interest or a delight of mine early on, because it was just really cool to see, you know, behind the covers, how stuff works. So I think taking that into my like kind of later education, beginning of my career, I think I was always kind of fiddling around with stuff and discovering things. And I suppose as a result of that, I had a lot of fodder for things to speak about, or at least things that I found interesting. I would sort of, at the same time though, I would kind of discourage people to think that that's necessarily what you need. Like I've heard, at the Elm meetup, I often try and encourage beginners to talk about stuff, even especially if they think it's something super obvious. So, you know, we had one of our meetup attendees spoke about, spoke about like why Elm, like why should you use Elm? And I really encouraged him, and I think he kind of initially felt that that was silly, because, you know, if you're at an Elm meetup, presumably you're already convinced that there's something interesting about it, right? And that's, then you would expect, oh, if you're going to do a talk about why Elm, why are you there? You know, you're kind of preaching to the choir, right? Like it's kind of like, you know, having a chocolate meetup and a bunch of people turn up and then you pitch to them why they should like chocolate. Well, it's like, guys, I mean, they came to the meetup. Like, of course they like chocolate, right? But that's not kind of really the point. And I think it also kind of sets a bit of a presumption that, oh, everybody that's there already knows what's going on. They have it together, which is definitely not true. You know, what actually happens is there's some people that might not know if they like Elm. They might be coming to see what the community's like. They might be on the edge, or this particular individual talked about bringing in Elm at their workplace and some of the challenges that they ran into, and how they justified the adoption of the language and the benefits and the risks and all that kind of stuff. So at the end of the day, even though it was maybe for some of us, you know, something that we already knew and believed, still just hearing it articulated in a different way still kind of has value. And it's also enjoyable to be part of seeing somebody else be able to grow. So, if there's listeners thinking that they have nothing interesting to talk about, it's also totally acceptable to just talk about something that might be obvious to you. It doesn't have to be new and novel every single time. Maybe the stakes are a little bit different when you're at a much larger conference. I think that's a little bit sad. It would be cool to have more beginners speaking about stuff. And I think some conferences do that a little bit better. But I suppose there you have like a kind of, what's it called? Like mismatched incentives, right? Because like for conferences, they're usually very large, they're very expensive, people pay lots of money to be there, they're expecting to get, you know, high quality or cutting edge context, maybe for some conferences. So maybe that's a little bit different. But again, I guess another skill that comes in there is this concept of know your audience, right? So kind of at a meetup, it's much more relaxed. Like if you're, hopefully your meetup conveys to its attendees that, you know, this is a safe space. It's okay to kind of do whatever. We're all happy here to be helping each other learn. Whereas, yeah, at a fully organized conference, maybe that's slightly more formal grounds where there's a level of baseline expected. Maybe not all conferences, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's all. That's what I've seen as well. I was really really amazed by a talk. And our friend gave at a conference about solid principle, which it was something like 2 years ago. I said, what's solid principles? And we have 2016, so people should know this by now. And the room was crammed with people standing everywhere, just to get this talk about solid principles. And I was abashed. And I had to realize that what you said, what you know or what you think you know is not where the other attendees are right now. And maybe they want to hear something something different and something that they think they should know about. And well, I always have a hard time when I'm participating to conference reviews or conference committees to align those incentives, as you say. It's really hard.
Mm. But yeah, so absolutely.
Have to go through that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Let's backtrack again. We've mentioned the word Elm a lot of time. Maybe it's time to define it. And if that's possible, how did you come up to finding out about Elm and being so stoked about it? So, can you guide us through this story, and then we can maybe define what Elm is and why it's so important for you?
Yeah, sure. So in short, Elm, as the website says, it's a delightful language for reliable web apps. But maybe in a few more words, it's a functional language written by a guy called Evan Tsiplicki, I believe is how it's pronounced. And it's a front-end language, so people that are interested in kind of visual user interfaces or doing front-end kind of work, that's kind of like the very focused target for that language to be super excellent. But how I fell into Elm, so Elm is a functional language, so in the realm of kind of functional languages as opposed to the other paradigm being imperative languages or declarative languages, maybe less popularly, but kind of imperative ones are the executional ones that a lot of people will know, like JavaScript and Java and C and can't even think of now Ruby, Python. You know, most of the popular languages, or at least the mainstream languages, are what we might call imperative languages, or and we might call them that because of specific properties. So they have mutation, which is in a particular part of my code, I can write some code that does something, that changes something in the real world, and it changes it then and there, exactly when that piece of code gets run. And then there's also the concept of kind of mutability. So the idea that as my program executes, I can change the state of my program. So say I have a counter, and my counter is zero, there might come to a piece of code where that counter now gets changed to one, and then get to another point where it changes to two. And that change is kind of visible across the whole program. So, you know, if I have two different pieces of code in two different places that both increment the counter but aren't aware of each other, you can get strange effects because, you know, one piece of code might have incremented it from zero to one, expecting it to be one, and another piece of code also does the same. So they both expect it to be one, but now instead it's two. So that's the concept of mutability. So where I kind of fell into the rabbit hole was I actually had a very good friend of mine while I was living in Melbourne who had come across Haskell. And Haskell was something that I studied in university and quite naively thought it was a stupid language that couldn't be used for anything practical because, of course, it has no mutability and it has no effects, and therefore it is dumb. And I was being very, very productive in PHP at the time, and obviously I knew everything, and therefore I was going to ignore that class, and I ended up dropping out, which is really sad now because it's become one of my favorite languages, and I think, oh, so many years wasted. There you go, youthful arrogance or exuberance, depending on your point of view. But yeah, I had after... yeah, maybe 7-8 years of doing that uni course, I had this friend come around and just be like, oh man, like, you know, I've learned this language, and it's the only thing. Like, there's nothing else. Everything else is terrible. This is the only one, and you have to learn it. And I kind of learned it out of spite, because I was like, no, it's not possible. Like, you know, I know stuff. I've been programming for a while. I can't believe that there would really be something that fundamentally different. And so a lot of the claims that were being made in terms of, you know, refactorability and stability and lack of bugs and totality and blah, 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 I was kind of like, nah, okay, you know, let me kind of dig into it and see how this actually shakes out in practice. And yeah, I just kind of got hooked, and I was just so blown away that something existed that was so fundamentally different yet the same still. And it took me a very long time to realize, like, oh, okay, you know, these concepts can be applied in other languages. Like you can, you know, take functional paradigms and transplant them into other languages. But like all things that are, I guess, you know, copycats or secondhand, you lose a little bit of that delight and joy of seeing it in its natural environment, right? So for me, it was kind of like an analogy I thought of recently. It's kind of like a zoo, right? Like, the tiger is pretty cool, right? But you're like, eh, yeah, tiger is cool, but, you know, there's also, like, I don't know, rhinos over there and giraffes and then the cages, and it's a lot of work, and you got to feed them and all this kind of stuff, right? And then when you go see those animals in their natural environment, it's the same animal, but it's a completely different kind of context. So that's kind of how it was for me with functional. And as I kind of fell more and more into that, I thought, okay, well, Haskell was really working for me for backend. But I was like, what is the picture for frontend? You know, I want this. I want these guarantees. I want these language features. I want this way of writing code in the front end. And there were a couple of options, like you could transpile Haskell to JavaScript, but it was really large. And there was PureScript as well, which was kind of similar, but there were a couple of things that didn't, you know, it felt a bit complicated to me. And I kept kind of digging around and came across Elm. Actually ignored it for the first time and then kind of came back again maybe 6 months later and just kind of started to really unravel for me how simple and just delightful of a language it is. So I would really recommend if you're curious about functional, Elm is a really, really nice kind of gateway drug into functional because it's very small and it's very contained, but it is just absolutely one of the most delightful languages that I've worked with. And yeah, in part, kind of a reason why I took up running the Elm meetups in London after they kind of stalled for a little bit with the previous person that was running them. Because yeah, I'd kind of finally come across a language in a community where I was like, okay, yeah, I really, really like this. I like the design kind of ethics behind it. I like the thinking behind it. And I can, you know, I feel myself be more productive and yeah, I think it's the most fun I've had in programming since learning programming. So that was pretty awesome for me.
Wow, that's a big statement. That's pretty cool. Yeah, a colleague of mine has started talking about Elm here in the region, and that was also a very at first an alien topic. Said, "Well, what Elm? Never heard about this." And then, okay, it's going to be about functional programming in the UI. What? And yeah. But it clicked. It really clicked. It was really sleek. It was really interesting. And I think that's something we should hear more from. But right now, it's still not completely on my radar yet. It hasn't really crossed over to the circles I'm roaming into. So I have to see why. It's
slowly.
Yeah,
gently.
how long has it been around?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably the early versions go back as maybe far as 6 or 7 years, but I think in its kind of current major incarnation, I think we're probably talking about 3 years or so. Just recently there was a major release, so 0.19 came out with some really, really interesting stuff. One in particular is that, you know, some of the language features that kind of Evan has bet on with Elm have panned out in the latest release, that he's been able to do some really interesting optimizations, in particular something called tree shaking or dead code elimination. And I was quite excited about it because, you know, some of these properties that we harp on about, on, you know, how good having immutability is and how good having purity is, all those particular items have allowed in this version for him to be so aggressive with dead code elimination that a full real world app is smaller in size once compiled than just the baseline libraries of React the other one that I've forgotten the name of, Vue.js. Mm-hmm. So that is super crazy, because it kind of means that, like, whatever optimizations you did in those other libraries, like, already they're bigger than the optimized full actual application real world app example, just with a baseline library. So to me, that was kind of like, wow, that's, you know, that's when you start like pulling out like the big guns of things that it's not just about putting the tiger in the zoo, right? Like, because it can't even compare to kind of environment. So yeah, anyway, as you can tell, I get quite passionate about this stuff.
You are. It's great listening to you. I see myself thinking code right now, although I don't code anymore, but that's cool. But let's talk about not coding anymore. You've said a few times that you reached a time in your career where you're more drifting into leadership, more drifting into people-centric stuff. Is it true? And the second question would be, how do you balance still this desire for coding and those new responsibilities?
Sure. I think kind of leadership wasn't something that I kind of intentionally went for. I think by kind of virtue of my early career experience and running a business, it was just kind of like the de facto thing. Like, you know, if you're the owner of the business, people look to you to lead them. But at the same time, I was, you know, definitely doing a ton of code and writing a whole bunch of stuff along with everybody else that was in our company. So the kind of maybe one way that I've rationalized it, and I think I might have even expressed this to you once when we were catching up, is I kind of think of it like the chief editor at a newspaper, right? Like if he's running around at work trying to write articles for the newspaper every single day, like you would expect that he would be able to do that. Like you would expect that he might be able to write a feature piece, but if he's running around and doing that all the time, rather than leading the team of people that are doing that, like, you know, he's not going to be as effective. So, that's not then to say that if he does step up into a leadership role, that he can, you know, now no longer read or write. And this may not be shared by all technology leaders, but at least for myself personally, I've kind of always felt quite wedded to the idea that just because I might be a leader at work and just because I might focus on higher level or bigger picture things, doesn't necessarily mean that I lose an interest in or that it's bad or that I shouldn't ever code. For me particularly, it's kind of changed throughout. Like there's been some jobs where I've had a blend in a leadership position. I've still kind of sat down and rolled up my sleeve, so to speak, from time to time. And then more recently, it's been on the other end of the spectrum where, you know, at work, I no longer touch any code. But as a result, then for myself and my own enjoyment, I do a lot of stuff as a hobby outside of work. So, I feel like maybe sometimes our industry is a little bit too heavy on the ladder. Maybe we're a bit too brutal, and you know, like for some people, it's like, oh, if you're seen to be coding still, like, you know, it's been said to me during my career, like, oh, you know, like he clearly can't, or she clearly can't, you know, let go of the coding bit. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that, you know, if you thought of it in the writing sense, like, you know, like you're not going to forget how to write things, right? Like it's kind of like a basic skill. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe there's some people that would have a fundamentally different opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a good approach. I mean, it's not really a problem of forgetting how to do it. It's more, do you have the time to invest yourself in this? You know, the focus, problem we have as creative people. You cannot just flip a switch and go from one meeting to being creative and just do that for 10 minutes and then go back to a second meeting. This just doesn't work like that. So you have to immerse yourself and you have to get in the flow. You have to get in the zone. And then maybe after 1 hour, you are in at this position of really being productive and doing something helpful. I think there was a blog post from, I don't remember who wrote that, one of the Silicon Valley venture capitalists, about I'm not going to have a name right, the maker schedule versus the manager schedule, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Something like this. Showing that those two kind of people work on a completely different schedule. The makers need long time of uninterrupted work. And the managers are just jumping from one topic to the other because what they are talking about is this jumping around. And those two just don't go really well with one another. And I think that's more the discrepancy that you see in managers still coding, is how do you balance the two? But if you found a way to do it for yourself, then great.
Yeah. No, I would definitely agree that maybe in the common, like in the general case, that's probably what you're dealing with in most companies. I've kind of wondered for a long time if it necessarily has to be that way. Something, again, I think I mentioned this to you last time we caught up. I've been reading a lot of the stuff that comes out of Basecamp. So the stuff from DHH and Jason Fried. Mm-hmm. And they actually have a book coming out soon that I'm going to assume, just based on the title, talks about this exact topic, and also just having read a bunch of their blog posts. But their new book is called The Calm Company. Mm-hmm. And they talk a lot about, it doesn't have to be crazy at work, right? And I know definitely, I don't know about you, but for myself, I've definitely come home and said that phrase to my wife many times, like, oh my God, it's so crazy at work. I have quite a lot of jealousy actually for Basecamp. I'm so curious as to what it would actually be like to work there and how it goes. But yeah, I mean, you've got their leaders that will routinely kind of step away and have time to do those other things. And there's a little, there's just something niggling in the back of my head, which is like, you know, is it that managers need to have a different schedule? Or is it that happens because you're not necessarily the best manager you could be? You know, like, if you were an awesome manager, maybe you would have time. Maybe everything would be fine. Or I don't know. Maybe awesome is the wrong word, but you get what I mean, right? Like, maybe there's a different setup that would result in schedules not being that different. Maybe. I don't know. Hmm. Anyway, something I've been pondering.
No, thank you. I will be pondering this from now on as well. That's a very interesting way to see it. While we're in the in advisors and slowly reaching the end of our time box, Elm was not an advice you could give, because you gave it already and we heard you already, which advice would you give to people either starting the career or changing the career or going into a new direction? What advice could you give them?
I think there's probably two things, and I don't know how original they are, so I'm really sorry if someone was hoping for something more more profound. But yeah, the two things that really strike out at me is just, one, absorb as much as you can, like knowledge from everywhere and anything. Someone that I really kind of look up to and admire when I was quite young said to me, like, there's something valuable in learning everything, like anything, like I'm butchering how he said it to me, because I remember it in my head much more profoundly. But I think the concept of what he was trying to say is, like, you know, say you get the chance to do knitting for some reason. No disrespect to people who like knitting, but I couldn't think of anything more stereotypical as something that you might not want, whatever it is. Say you have to do something that you don't want to do or that you don't like, and his kind of advice kind of really kind of burrowed into my brain. That's like, even if you don't like it, even if it's not your thing, or you don't think that there's particular value to you in it, just be patient and try and seek it out, and there will be something there to learn, and there will be something that has value and applies to something else in life later on. So I don't know, maybe you can go too far on that front. Like, I have definitely been told off sometimes for having too many hobbies and being interested into too many things and kind of moving from one thing to another. You can definitely have kind of shiny object syndrome. But I don't know. I feel like it kind of fostered in me this idea that like, there's always something to be learned. So I read quite prolifically. I kind of churn up lots of blog posts and, you know, the programming Reddit, even though sometimes a lot of it is trash. Like, again, you could still kind of look through and find something useful. So anyway, the one side would be just like, always learn and be open to learn and be open to the fact that even in crap situations or situations that you're not the happiest, that there's still something that you can kind of draw out from that. And the second one, I suppose, would be the other direction out. So maybe not necessarily teaching, but communicating. Like, I think I'm increasingly more baffled that it's not a bigger part of curriculum in schools, given how much of our lives are dependent on it, and how much the quality of your life can change just purely based on how good you are at communicating not only knowledge, but your own needs and desires or whatever it might be. So I think, the art of good communication, which is not necessarily obvious. And there's tons and tons of literature, and you can kind of, I suppose you could make a career out of just learning a lot of this stuff, right? Like each individual topic that you could get into is a whole industry and field and a whole bunch of stuff. But I think kind of 80-20 rule applies, right? Like with kind of 20% of the kind of effort, I think you can really get a good sense of that 80% chunk of the essence of something. So ingest as much as you can, but also learn about how to actually leverage that knowledge, because there's no point ingesting all of that knowledge if you can't effectively use it and spread it and articulate it and communicate it. So I'm sorry to prospective listeners, it's a bit of a boring cliche thing, but I think it's super fundamental, and then things stack on top of that, right? So whatever you're passionate about or whatever you decide to get into kind of stacks on top of that, and I think it's always a ton more powerful if you're fantastic at absorbing information and communicating it out. So you had another question, which is, you know, what's a good software developer? And to me, that's that. Like, the people that I've absolutely loved working with have been people that have always been interested to learn something, and they're keen. Even if it's not for them, they'll entertain it for a time, and then the communication part, you know, they can simply say, hey, you know, thanks for sharing that with me, I see you're really passionate for about it, that's awesome, you know, it just doesn't happen to be for me, that's okay, and even just being able to communicate that is pretty cool. So yeah, amen. Two birds, one stone, there you go.
Amen to that. It's really profound. That's great stuff. That's great stuff. Thank you for that. I guess we reached the end of our time box. Did we miss something? Did we miss a topic you wanted to talk about?
Not particularly. I think we meandered around a little bit. It was quite nice. That was enjoyable.
With it. So one question I have for you is, where can the listeners find you and reach you and get in touch with you if you want to?
Yeah, sure. So, Twitter is probably the easiest and most public. My Twitter handle is at RealMario. But you can also find me, I'm quite active on the Elm Lang Slack if you're interested in Elm, or even if you're not, like the Slack channel is pretty cool. We have about, I think it's coming up to about 15,000 members on there now. Just Google Elm Lang Slack and you can find that. There's a really awesome community there. People are insanely lovely and helpful and patient, and it's really quite enjoyable. But yeah, you can ping me there. My handle is Super Mario, which is the same as my GitHub handle if you kind of want to poke around at some of the projects that I'm kind of like slowly meandering on with. You can also get me via email if you really want. My email is hello@mario.net.au. If you want to ask anything at all, I'm always really happy to get email and respond to folks. But yeah, mm-hmm. That's it, I think.
I think it was the last question, but I just realized I have another one. Do you have something on your plate? Do you have conferences coming up, places where people can meet you, maybe the Elm?
Actually, in London? I do. I'm very, very excited. I have for a very long time wanted to go to Strange Loop, the conference in the States. And this year, that's actually something that I've been able to line up. So I don't even know. It's a couple of weeks now, maybe three, four weeks away. Yeah, 3 weeks away. I'll be at Strange Loop in the last week of September. So if you happen to be there, that'd be really awesome. Outside of that, no, nothing else particular planned for the rest of the year. But I am always at the Elm London meetups. So that's another way if you wanted to come chat with me in person or go for a coffee or a drink. The Elm London meetups run monthly, usually the last or the second last Wednesday of the month. But look for us on meetup.com. I post all the events up there, and I also tweet about them and announce them every single time. So both of those places in the upcoming months.
Awesome. Then I hope you will get a ton of messages and a lot of people bugging you, and that would be fun. And
that would be very cool.
Have fun at Strange Loop then.
All right, awesome. Thanks again for having me, Tim. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Mario. This has been another episode of Developer's Journey, and we'll see each other in 2 weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye. listener. If you haven't subscribed yet, you can find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Music, and much more. And if you like what we do, please help your fellow developers discover the podcast by rating it and writing a comment on those platforms. Thanks again, and see you in 2 weeks.